The next case is 04-1239, Lois Marie Coleman versus Vigram Dogra, M.D. Mr. Garner.
Richard Garner on behalf of the University Hospital Defendants. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, which will be presented by Mr. Sullivan. This court's already heard substantial arguments this morning about whether Ohio common law should recognize the claim of wrongful birth, and there are many more in the briefs by the parties that we do not have adequate time to address today in the short time we have to argue. I'll submit to you, though, that both of these cases will be decided on two pivotal issues. The first is an issue of liability. We've already heard some discussion about that. That is whether these cases are damages about the life of a child with a naturally occurring untreatable genetic deformity, or whether they're about the deprivation of the right to an abortion, or lost opportunity to abort, as it's been called. Each of the defendants in the cases before you has argued that wrongful birth is not a valid cause of action in Ohio common law because a plaintiff cannot prove legal causation or cognizable damages under any set of facts, going back to the Chief Justice's questions about the elements of negligence. Because the focus of this claim centers upon the life of a child with a naturally occurring untreatable genetic deformity, the plaintiffs are arguing that they and their children would be better off had their children never been born. And in this topsy-turvy argument, death becomes a remedy and life becomes an injury. And because this argument strips the common law of a central axiom which is necessary for the common law to function, the claim must fail as a matter of law. Because as this court said in Hester versus Duivetti, when it was rejecting the related claim of wrongful death or wrongful life, quote, courts are not equipped to assume the tasks of comparing the value of life in an impaired state and non-existence. Life, however impaired and regardless of any attendant expenses, cannot rationally said to be a detriment when compared to the alternative of non-existence. In short, the status of being alive does not constitute an injury, end quote.
Now, the counsel, in your case, the consequential damages that are sought are principally non-economic, aren't they?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So your case, unlike the previous one, the economic damages, because the child died very soon after birth, are not a substantial factor in the case. It's the non-economic damages that the parents, particularly the mother, claim. I'm wondering what is the purpose of conducting an ultrasound?
The purpose of a number of things in terms of development. Obviously, the purpose, one of the principal purposes, and I think what you're getting at, Justice Pfeiffer, is one of the principal purposes is to see whether or not the child is developing correctly. And at that point in time, they can determine.
So if it's not?
If it's not, then there's a number of options that could take place, including termination of the pregnancy by abortion. I think that's stated, it's given in both cases.
Okay. So the principal purpose is to assist family in deciding whether or not this pregnancy should go forward.
I don't think there's any question that that's a fact, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then the other part of your case, because it's at a pleading stage only, is the allegation that this was a incorrectly done or the data was insufficient to assist the parents in that determination, and nothing appropriate was done to follow up on that. Is that the gist of the
case? That would be the essence
of
the plaintiff's case, yes, Your Honor.
So this is strictly a lost opportunity case, and then the question, do non-economic damages, if we recognize the claim or say it can go forward, standard tort kind of claim with all the standard tort defenses, whether or not the non-economic claim is one that should be recognizable and compensable.
I believe those are all components. I will disagree with one point, Justice Pfeiffer, which is no matter what we call these cases, this is not going to just be traditional tort. And I think when we get to the issue of damages, which I'm going to address here in a moment, we'll see that this court has already said in these types of cases, in fact, it might have been your decision as well. No, it might have been Justice Douglas, I apologize, who basically indicated that traditional tort rules are not going to work in these types of cases because of the types of injuries which are claimed. But otherwise, I basically agree.
I think I wrote exactly the opposite in Hester.
And that may well be, as I indicated, it may have been Justice Douglas in the Johnson case which indicated that.
But here, let's stay with it for just a moment longer. Then you're saying traditional tort doesn't work. I'm suggesting it might, does, can. Wouldn't you be arguing, if you're now in trial, or whoever would be trying the case for the defendants, that the emotional trauma to this woman could perhaps be almost the same if she had had to terminate the pregnancy knowing that she bore a child with this condition?
I suppose that's a possibility, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be what a defense attorney would argue?
I don't know that we would argue this in this case, Your Honor. Again, when we look at the facts of this case, the reason why we're making the arguments we're making in this case isn't because there's a challenge to the fact that there was a duty in this case. I don't think anyone questions whether or not there was a duty owed to the plaintiff, nor do we question whether or not there's at least a genuine issue of material fact as to the breach of that duty. We disagree that there has been a breach, but certainly there's at least a genuine issue of material fact. The question is causation and damages as to liability. Now, the plaintiff's negligence claims are properly characterized as wrongful birth claims. We've talked about those labels. And the defendants have collectively argued that wrongful life and wrongful birth claims are two sides of the same coin. And for all the reasons why this court has rejected claims for wrongful life in Hester, it should reject the claims for wrongful birth in this case. But here we get to the crux of the matter. The plaintiffs counter that there's a legal distinction between wrongful life and wrongful birth claims, and that they assert that wrongful life claims, while they may be legally deficient under Ohio common law because a child cannot prove legal causation or cognizable damages, wrongful birth claims are different because the mother of the genetically deformed child suffered a distinct legal injury. They argue that she was negligently deprived of her constitutionally recognized right to terminate her pregnancy, and that she can stay.
Can I interject a question at that point? The first ultrasound was done when she was approximately 4 months pregnant. Was abortion possible at that time?
I would imagine, we haven't looked at that issue, but I would imagine it probably would be at that point in time.
At 4 months?
I would imagine we're in the second trimester at that point in time. Constitutionally, it would likely be permitted.
Would be possible.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So the argument that's made is that this is a distinct legal injury because we're talking about the deprivation of the right of a constitutionally protected right to abortion. But I submit to you that the mother gains nothing by trying to characterize her suit as a suit for the deprivation of a constitutionally protected right to abortion, because the focus of the claim remains on her child's naturally occurring untreatable genetic deformity. And that focus doesn't change by trying to wrap the claim in a constitutional wrapper. And I can point this court to the case of Anderson versus St. Francis St. George Hospital, which indicated that if you wrap this type of a claim in a constitutional wrapper, it doesn't change the nature of the claim. Now, you'll recall that the Anderson case did not involve a prenatal tort, and it did not involve a genetic deformity. It involved issues at the other end of life. But the case provides principles that should be controlling on liability in this particular case. And Anderson, the elderly man, was admitted for heart problems. He said he wanted to have a do not resuscitate order that was put on. The do not resuscitate order was violated when he went into heart arrhythmia. He was resuscitated, and as a result, he suffered a stroke, was paralyzed until his death 2 years later. He filed suit before his death against the hospital for his resuscitation, and this court described his suit as a wrongful living cause of action. And it described that wrongful living cause of action as follows, quote, "The plaintiff is asserting a liberty interest in refusing unwanted medical treatment. It is the denial of this liberty interest when the medical professional either negligently or intentionally disregards the express wishes of a patient that gives rise to the cause of action," end quote.
This court then analogized directly to wrongful birth and wrongful life claims and rejected Winter's claim, explaining that Winter could not state a cause of action, no matter what he called his claim, because he was seeking damages for the prolongation of life, and such damages were not permissible under the common law.
But those are very different damages than are sought here, certainly. The damages here are sought not by the patient or the estate, but by the parents who've had to claim they had, you know, we know they lost their opportunity to make a decision that they wanted to make.
Correct. And the individual holding the liberty interest is different, but the fact of the matter is that characterizing it as a liberty interest didn't change the fact. And when we go to the issue of damages, and I'll jump ahead on that, because I'm running out of time here, when we go to the issue of damages,
your co-counsel's time.
Right, and we look at the wrongful pregnancy case. You will remember that in Bowman versus Davis, the reason why this court recognized wrongful pregnancy is because it determined that this was a liberty interest, the right not to procreate. And nevertheless, when the court considered the issue of damages, it said, okay, if we're going to have damages in this case, despite the fact that we have a liberty interest involved, it's still only going to be the limited damages. And the reason why is because the damages are going to be tied to the actual injury, the deprivation of the liberty interest. And in that case, damages then will be limited to the pregnancy and childbirth itself, which is exactly what should happen in this case. If this court finds that the plaintiffs can get past liability, then all they're left with under the Johnson case is limited damages. This court has already considered those issues in Johnson and has considered the issues in Simmerer with an unhealthy child. And in both of those cases, the proper measure of damages was determined to be the limited damages rule, which is limited to obstetric costs and childbirth and other minor damages in this particular case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garner. Mr. Sullivan, do you wait? You want to wait for take yours for rebuttal? On rebuttal?
Your time, please.
Okay. Mr. DeRoche.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jim DeRoche. I'm here on behalf of Lois Coleman. From our perspective, I think this case boils down to really the issue of whether or not this court is going to find that the deprivation of a constitutionally protected right to choose to terminate a pregnancy is going to be recognized or not. And whether or not, along with that, that this court is going to actually hold that being deprived of that right to make a decision on your own behalf that is yours to make.
Could your client have
harm.
Taken advantage of partial birth abortion?
Your Honor, no, that she could not have.
Why?
In our case, she wasn't advised of the defect, ever. And that's the crux of the major source of what we say is the emotional harm in this case. If she had been properly informed of the defect that was actually shown on the ultrasound, she would have had the option to seek counseling, to have someone assist her in making it the decision that she was faced with, and I recognize it's a Hobson's choice. In all these cases, it is. And she would have been able to actually make the decision in that case to abort the pregnancy based on the fetal defect.
Counsel, doesn't the mother always have the option to abort? I mean, you talk about the deprivation of the constitutional right. There was no deprivation here. At any point, she could have voluntarily chosen that option.
We're not saying, Your Honor, that this child was unwanted, and we've never said that in this case. She willingly bore this child and was willing to carry the child to term and to be a mother. In fact, her willingness to do so and her expectation that that was going to be the result is the major, major source of harm, the emotional harm in this case.
It's always after the fact, then. I mean, the public policy here is, shouldn't it be of concern if we were to find in your favor, we would be saying to anyone that if the child has these types of defects, this type of claim then can be made, that, well, if I would have known under these circumstances, I would not have given birth. It is that slippery slope that we're talking about, are we not?
I don't believe it's a slippery slope for the very reason that the ship has sailed on that issue and the United States Supreme Court has held that it is the mother's choice to make. And the duty here is to provide her with the accurate information to allow her to make that choice. It's a corollary duty to what is a recognized right of the mother. It's her decision and hers alone to make. It's not the doctor's decision. It's not any court's decision to make. It's her decision to make. And she has a right to have the accurate information. They don't dispute that. What they're saying is that the deprivation of that right causes no harm. In other words, Ms. Coleman being told all is well with your pregnancy, being sent home to set up her nursery, carrying the child to term, giving birth to a profoundly, terminally defective child by surprise, having to watch that child suffer and die in agony for 12 days, isn't harm. At bottom, that is what they're arguing. That is what they want this court to tell prospective mothers in the state of Ohio through a holding that this cause of action doesn't exist.
Counsel, the same question that Justice O'Donnell asked, I'd like to ask, and that is, with all of the advances in medication and eugenics and the balancing and testing, why is this not really a public policy decision that should be made by the legislature with all the input from all the groups that have an interest, instead of us sitting here in a vacuum with a 30-page, 50-page brief making these type of decisions?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it is this court's recognized duty to develop the contours of tort law in this state. It has never shirked from that duty in the past, and we believe it should not shirk from its duty here. We have enough problems with the attacks on the judiciary from the other branches without this court ceding its authority to develop tort law voluntarily.
That may be depending on the philosophy of the bench at the moment, but I think that those lines between what the court should develop as tort law and what the legislature should develop as tort law is really an issue of judicial restraint, is it not?
Your Honor, judicial restraint comes up when the court treads on areas that maybe the court should not tread upon. And I believe this, in an issue of common law tort and in the development of the contours of the negligence cause of action, for 200 years, that's been this court's responsibility. We are saying, just like in Johnson, where the court didn't shirk its responsibility to make the tough decision, that when you have duty, breach of duty, which are established here, because the harm may be difficult to determine, the court should not shirk from its duty to find a cause of action and to actually rule on the issue of damages. This court, has never shied away from developing the in the area of tort law and making the difficult decisions. And I recognize this is not an easy decision to make. I think when you have duty, breach of duty, as we have here, I think Johnson really established a ruling from this court that this court must, under those circumstances, make the determination of what damages are appropriate. I honestly don't think that this court can legitimately rule that Lois Coleman did not suffer harm by virtue of the fact that she was told that all was well with her pregnancy and carried this child to term and was surprised by a profoundly defective child who enjoyed nothing but suffering. No parent gets any enjoyment from watching their child suffer and die. And in this,
she would have had that same conclusion had she chosen an abortion. She would have basically let her child die. So where is the difference, other than the fact that there was a period of time that it took a longer period? But you're basically saying the child died here. We would have terminated the child earlier. It's still a death that you're seeking.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that the difference is night and day. During a pregnancy, as it continues, there is a bonding process that the mother goes through. There is, to make the decision, I'm not saying the decision to abort wouldn't have been difficult, it would have been difficult, likely, but there would have been counseling, and it would have been done at a time when there was less bonding that occurred. And I think there's a world of difference between choosing an abortion because you know of a defect in utero versus being surprised at birth by the birth of a child who is profoundly defective and is not going to live that you think is going to be normal. Those two circumstances are completely at odds with each other.
Do you have the obligation then at trial to prove that this mother would in fact have aborted? Because a lot of people would say,
whether their child has a defect or not, we are not aborting. So is that a duty that you would have to establish at trial?
Yes, in every wrongful birth case, Your Honor, that is an element. We have to show that. Yes. And in this case, given the defect that we're talking about here, this child was never going to have a chance to survive. Most circumstances, people other than people that have a strong religious or other reason for being completely against abortion are likely going to make the humane decision. Why have this child just for it to suffer for 12 days and die? There was no enjoyment of life and under any circumstances here. And so I think that we could carry that burden at trial. Going back again to the proximate cause issue, the way they raise the proximate cause issue is, I think, by focusing on the damage to the child instead of putting the focus where the focus needs to be in these types of cases, which is on the damage to the parents, the mother in this case. The damage claim has nothing to do with the damage, direct damage to the child, but rather its effect and what its effect would have been under the correct circumstances to the mother. So I think by shifting the focus, they try to raise the metaphysical impossibility of life versus non-life that was rejected in Hester and Anderson. But again, in this claim, and I think the court in Hester, in fact, recognized that that's an inaccurate argument. That in this case, the parent's claim is conceptually different from the claim that's asserted by the child. In fact,
so the claim that you're asserting is limited to the mother's loss of the right to abort. Am I right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the damages you're seeking are for the care of the child throughout the child's lifetime.
Your Honor, we had a child that died
Am
in 12
I right?
days.
I understand that.
I can get to the
but
damage
the rule
issue.
Of law that you want us to write is that the damages are for the care of the child throughout the child's lifetime.
That's not accurate, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's
would
not
you
accurate.
Correct me and,
yes.
and would you clarify
I understand
your position?
That because that's a difficult issue that I think I need to clarify. The damage claim that we believe this court should recognize is the emotional trauma and harm, which under Johnson, I think under footnote 8 of Johnson, has already, an exception to the physical injury rule has already been established, so I don't think there should be any problem with that element. And then the extraordinary cost rule, which has been recognized throughout by the courts that have recognized the cause of action, and that is the costs relating directly to the treatment of the defect. That, I think, given the foreseeability of those damages under these circumstances, is the only correct rule that this court could establish. Again, proximate cause is as you raised earlier, we have an issue of public policy here. Well, proximate cause, it really does depend very often on public policy. I think this court has ruled, in fact, and described it in fact that way. Where you have but-for cause, we're going to put limits based on policy and foreseeability. In this case, we not only have a situation where it's foreseeable, we have a situation where, according to our expert, it should have actually been foreseen. This outcome should have been foreseen.
Would
so
there be a duty on part of your client to mitigate damages? I mean, I understand you're in this case, the child only lived for 12 days, but would there be a duty to mitigate damages in cases like this?
Your Honor, no. This court has soundly rejected that in Johnson. They said that the mitigation rule only requires reasonable measures. Putting your child up for adoption is not a reasonable measure that this court is willing to foist upon parents that are in this position, not by their choosing, but by the medical negligence of their providers. Again,
is the parent's claim here a derivative claim of the child?
No, and that feeds directly into our argument on why the focus needs to be on the parents. We're talking about the parents' harm, the difference between knowing and making the decision with correct information, being able to decide what's medically necessary with correct information versus being put in a position where you're not given that information and all the adverse consequences to the parents flow from that. It's not a derivative claim, Your Honor.
It's not a claim akin to negligent infliction of emotional distress here?
No, and I, Your Honor, I know that has been an argument that's been raised. This is negligent infliction of emotional distress, and therefore it shouldn't be recognized. I have two primary arguments on that. The first is that the Johnson Court has already recognized in the wrongful pregnancy area that emotional damages can be recovered by the parents.
As a result of the failure or to be able to choose, the deprivation of that?
In that particular case, it's a failure of a sterilization, negligent sterilization. They got pregnant and had a child. That was, in fact, a healthy child. But nonetheless, right. They said that you're entitled to emotional damages. So this court is in this broad general area has already recognized that this area is different, and we're going to have an exception for emotional damages. It's been recognized in the wrongful pregnancy area. Secondly, I think that we cited it in the Cash case, it's an out-of-state case, but it really deals with the issue of the policy behind the physical contact rule and the court's unwillingness to recognize negligent infliction of emotional distress really has to do with the fraudulent claim problem and whether or not you're going to have feigned emotional distress claims. And that's, frankly, not a legitimate argument here. I think that there's no question. I don't think anybody's going to argue that this woman didn't suffer severe emotional distress from this circumstance. In fact, she lost a whole semester of school following this because of the extreme emotional trauma that it caused to her. So, again, the feigned, the fraudulent claims issue is not an issue. I guess the last argument I would make on that is I personally would think it's insulting to characterize the parent's situation in this case as one of a mere bystander. They're not a bystander to the tragedy that befalls the family when they are denied this information and denied their right to make an informed choice. So I think that for those reasons, emotional trauma, even if it is a negligence case, should be allowed in these cases. And in terms of the extraordinary cost rule, I think the decision in Simmerer and the door that was left open by both the plurality decision and the concurrence by Justice Pfeiffer, I think, supports an award of the extraordinary costs of care in this case. In that case, the court found wanting the close proximate cause link, the close link between the negligence and the defect, the birth with a defect. It was missing there because the sterilization wasn't sought in order to prevent the type of defect that was at issue. In these cases, the care that's sought is precisely for that reason. You do have that close forged link between the lack of due care and the defect. And therefore, the issue the missing link, as you were, that was in Simmerer that caused the rejection of the extraordinary costs recovery in Simmerer is not present here. In fact, I would think in our cases, the elements of breach and the elements of foreseeability and proximate cause are, in fact, converge. Because in order to prove breach, you have to prove that the medical care provider should have foreseen the defect and informed the parents.
You need to sum up.
So I think the foreseeability element is here in spades in these types of cases.
Thank you, Mr. Drucker.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan, you have a little less than 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Brian Sullivan. I have the pleasure of representing Dr. Dagra in this appeal this afternoon. Regardless of how plaintiff's claims are characterized, they must fail as a matter of law because plaintiff cannot establish that the medical provider's conduct proximately caused any legally cognizable damages. As this court recently held in the Simmerer case in 2002, that a physician's negligence in performing a sterilization procedure did not proximately cause medical expenses and the emotional distress arising from giving birth to a child with defects. Now, this court in Hester has identified the fact that a birth with defects includes two separate components, a birth and a child with defects. In this case, there is no question that the medical providers were not responsible for causing the defects within which this child suffered, and as a result, are not responsible for paying for the medical expenses associated with treating the child with those conditions. Additionally, It must be kept in mind that all of plaintiff's damages flow through the prism of the fact that this child was born with medical defects. This court has repeatedly recognized in Hester, in Anderson, and in Bauman that the law does not sanction an award of damages on the relative merits of being versus non-being, no matter how impaired the life is, and no matter how expensive the attendant circumstances associated with that life are. But for this child's birth with defects, the plaintiff would have no damages. To the extent that their argument is couched in terms of a lost opportunity to have terminated the pregnancy, had proper medical advice been provided, we would submit that this court has answered the question over whether or not that claim gives rise to a claim for legally cognizable damages in the Anderson case. And as Mr. Gardner pointed out, that is not a case that dealt with the causes of action at the beginning of life, but the cause of action that potentially existed at the close of life. And in Anderson, this court determined that the deprivation of a liberty interest, i.e., in that case, the right to die by refusing medical treatment, does not give rise to legally cognizable damages when those damages result in the elongation of life. And we would submit that in this case, the conduct of the medical professionals resulted in the birth of this child, the elongation of this child's life. And as this court answered in the Anderson case, that is not a legally cognizable damages. That is not a legally cognizable damage. As a result, the plaintiffs have failed to establish proximate cause and have failed to establish a legally cognizable damage. And consequently, the judgment of the appellate court should be reversed, and the claims not recognized by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.